WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we conclude our big, bombastic, brassy, and trashy week. And the emphasis this time is on trashy. It's trashy we like, or guilty pleasure trashy. But there's something here to please or offend almost everybody. We replay some of Terry's interview with Triumph the Insult comic dog from Late Night with Conan O'Brien. We visit with humorist David Rakoff from Public Radio's This American Life, who talks about soap operas. And we start our trashy day and the conclusion of our big, bombastic, brassy, and trashy week with filmmaker John Waters. It's almost hard to believe, in a world where horse intestines are eaten on Fear Factor, that John Waters was once considered an unbelievably outrageous envelope pusher. Yet he made his reputation in film that way, with such movies as Pink Flamingos, the 1972 raunch comedy starring sleaze queen Divine.
Could you give us some of your political beliefs?
Kill everyone now. Condone first-degree murder. Advocate cannibalism. Eat shit. Filth are my politics. Filth is my life. Take whatever you like.
Eventually, Waters made films that were more aimed at and accepted by mainstream audiences. Movies like Hairspray, which later became a hit Broadway musical, and Crybaby, which gave Johnny Depp a starring role way back in 1990. His next film, A Dirty Shame, comes out next month. Terry Gross spoke with John Waters last year about an exhibition of his photographs called John Waters' Change of Life, which is now available as a book. Many of the photographs in the book and exhibition are tributes to Waters' favorite films, which, not surprisingly, include many old exploitation films and tawdry melodramas. One of them is the 1957 film Peyton Place. Here's a scene from that film. Lana Turner plays a widow who hasn't been with a man in many years. Lee Phillips is the town's new high school principal. He's just kissed her.
All men are alike. The approach is different, but result is always the same. Sooner or later, we get around to this.
Now look, if all I wanted was a woman, I could get one any place. In a bar, in a hotel lobby, on a street corner.
Or in my home.
I'm not going to let you make anything dirty out of this.
Then what do you call it?
I'm going to tell you a hard truth about yourself. It isn't sex you're afraid of. You can say yes or no to that. It's love. That's what you can't handle.
And that's what you're offering me, with your hands all over me.
That's only one expression of it, backed up by many things.
Well, I haven't asked for any of them.
You'd better understand what you're saying no to. When I take you in my arms, I'm committing myself to you, not just physically, but all the way. That means that I intend to worry about you, to take care of you, to stand in front of you if there's trouble. And that's what I want back from you, without any reservations or shame or embarrassment. Now, either you're up to that or you're not.
I have my standards and my pride.
They're not enough, not for you or for anyone else. You need someone to trust, to love.
No, I don't. I don't. Now, just leave me alone.
I can do that, too, but I don't want to. Connie, let me help you. I don't care if you hang back. If it takes time, I'll give it time. All you need.
I can't.
The offer's always open.
A scene from the film Peyton Place. Waters told Terry how Peyton Place figured into his life when he was growing up.
Peyton Place was the first dirty book I ever read. I love Grace Natalia.
How dirty was it? I've never read the book.
The V of Betty's crotch.
Uh-huh, okay.
About that dirty. But in 1956, that was pretty dirty. And, it's a great... You ought to read Peyton Place. There's many sequels to it. It opens up, Indian Summer is like a woman. That's the first line. But Grace Metellus, you know, has that famous author shot of her in the lumberjacket and the dirty ponytail sitting at the typewriter. And I was so obsessed, I even went to her grave. I went in her house where she wrote the book. But Peyton Place itself, when the book came out, I remember the ad campaign is, how did they make a movie out of Peyton Place or something like that. But whenever they got to a sexual scene, they would cut to a cutaway shot of symbolism, like if someone was frigid, they'd have a frozen lake, or if somebody was getting turned on, they'd show a blossom in spring. So it was all corny nature shots, and it looks like bad National Geographic shots, but actually it's dirty shots. It's what they couldn't show then. So I tried to concentrate on what was thought of as sexy then, and to show today how ludicrous, but maybe even sexier if you don't see it, because we're so used to seeing everything today.
That's really funny. When you were growing up and you started to watch films passionately, who were your first favorite movie stars?
My first favorite movie stars? I guess Elvis Presley. You know, I liked directors when I was young. I liked William Castle. I liked Kroger Babb, the one that they told us we'd go to hell if we saw his movies.
Who's
where
that?
He did Mom and Dad. He showed The Birth of a Baby for the first time. And he was a carny. He later even made a movie called One Too Many that he only showed at AA meetings, which I really like. That's a new kind of exploitation that I'm all for. I'm a carny too, basically.
What are the movies that you used to watch over and over again as a kid on TV or going to the movies time and time again to see it?
Yes, certainly. The Tingler, all the William Castle movies. And I did a piece in the show that shows William Castle's face. No, it shows William Castle's face, and then it has Alfred Hitchcock next to him, because everybody accused William Castle, who was king of the gimmicks in his films, of ripping off Alfred Hitchcock. But in a way, it was the other way around, because Alfred Hitchcock, people forget, when Psycho came out, the big ad campaign was that no one can enter the theater once the feature has begun, which was unheard of at the time. You forget. People used to go to the movies at any time and just stay through to the next part of the film. They never cleared the theater. So there was a clock in every box office, so you'd know, and it was a big, big gimmick. So in a way, he was king of the gimmicks also, and he copied William Castle, who in a way did it first. So I've always, in a way, liked the second rate better. I mean, William Castle I liked more than Alfred Hitchcock. Jane Mansfield I liked more than Marilyn Monroe. Salminio, I liked him really a lot, though. I didn't feel he was inferior, but he was maybe, I liked Salminio even more than James Dean. I always liked the wrong person. I always rooted for the wrong person, and I always thought that the people that other people thought were ugly were better looking. That's always been my life, and my career has kind of been based on that.
You also have a series called Inga that are, this is stills from a Swedish, quote, art film?
Well, art film. Art meant dirty when I was young, and that's the way it should stay. Inga was one of the Sweden, you know, the Bergman movies, when they first came out in Baltimore, were sold as sex films because they had a little bit of nudity in them. And Sweden became a code word for dirty. Still, the dirty bookshop in Baltimore is called the Sweden Bookshop. I'm not making this up. So I love the idea. I tried to put Inga in, but I just showed the back of somebody. I showed no nudity. I showed the one shot in a sex film that you would never reproduce, that would never become a still. It is the sexy girl walking away from you out of focus, a shot that no one would ever produce. All the stills in this show are ones that would never be produced. I did a whole series called Marks, where I just took photographs off the floor when I was making my movie Pecker of the tape marks that the crew puts down that the actors have to hit to stay in focus. And that's the only thing in the shot. Everything that would be in a movie is gone. The actors, the costumes, the props, and all that's left is the one thing you can't show in a movie still.
Since a few of the shots in your book allude to, you know, erotic movies or porn movies, I'm wondering how you discovered pornography as a kid.
Gee, how did I discover porn as a kid? Peyton Place was the first dirty book I had ever read, and I had heard about it, certainly. Mandingo was another one, and that's like kind of a great movie. And Playboy. I mean, Playboy was the first thing that you could ever really see. Now, gay porn was a very, very different thing. There was a store called Sherman's downtown that had those magazines like Vim and Vigor, and they were supposedly Muscle Man magazines, but it was kind of a coded thing. It was the first gay magazines I ever saw.
Did your father have pornographic books or men's magazines around that you could sneak peeks at?
No, he didn't. But he did have Peyton Place, and I did read his copy of Peyton Place.
Did he read that because that was the kind of book he liked, or because that was the only kind of like legitimate erotic literature,
you know,
he could read in the house?
I don't know that. You'd have to ask my father that, and I doubt he'd answer. Everyone had Peyton Place. My grandfather had Peyton Place. Peyton Place was the biggest number one bestseller for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it led to Jackie Suzanne. It led to Jackie Collins. It led to that entire genre of work. But she did it first, and she did it best, and she had such great titles. Another one of her books was The Tight White Collar, about a priest. That's such a good title. But she didn't handle success so well. I mean, she divorced her husband, she moved to the Plaza Hotel, and she drank too much and died, basically. So that's not the best success story. But the book was so famous that when I went back to New Hampshire, where she wrote the book, they still talk mean about her there in the town. And the library only had one tattered copy. But I did go to her grave. And Grace has been a great heroine of mine. And actually, Roseanne Barr should play her in the movie because she could really play her well, actually.
What was her gravesite like?
Ostentatious and much larger than any of the other gravestones there. And people leave liquor bottles near it sometimes.
When you started finding pornography, straight pornography, what was it like? What was it like reading or seeing photos that were fetishizing women's bodies when women's bodies weren't what it was about for you?
Well, when I looked at those pictures, I always looked at it in a way to see how far it could go. The same way I went to heterosexual sexploitation movies all the time that had no male nudity to see how far it could go. I was interested in how the taboos would fall, how it started with nudist camp movies were the first things I saw, and you would see bare breasts on women and sometimes asses. But once in a while, a male ass. But they had to be playing volleyball, so, you know, that was not so erotic to me. It's hard to imagine, even on your horniest night, a sexy volleyball fantasy. So, a naked volleyball fantasy. I've never had a night where I'm that horny. Let's put it that way. So I just kept watching and to see how far it could go. Each time something crumbled, no matter if it, I guess certainly in the heterosexual world with sexual imagery, when that began to crumble, you knew that the homosexual imagery was not far behind, but the heterosexual had to crumble first.
How did you get to see the nudist camp movies? And these were movies that ostensibly were supposed to be documentaries about healthy alternative lifestyles and so on, but they were really about the nudity. Where did they play? Where did you get to see them?
I can tell you right where. One of my favorite theaters, the Rex Movie Theater in Baltimore, which is now a church. When I was young, it started out and I saw The Wizard of Oz there, but it later became a nudie movie theater where I not only saw nudist camp movies, I saw the early Russ Meyer movies, I saw the Ghoulies and the Ruffies, and it was one man who owned it who fought the censorship board. We had the Maryland Censorship Board, and censorship has always been something I fought, and I even have a piece in the show where a curtain goes over the imagery for censorship in case your parents are coming over, that you can close it. So I've always dealt with censorship. So the Rex Theater was where I got a lot of my film education in Baltimore.
Did you ever feel guilty for your tastes that were about violating all the standards of decency?
No, I never felt guilty. I always knew. I told the story before, but when I was young, I heard my parents talking about me. You know, you listen at the top of the steps, and my mom said, "Well, he's just an odd duck." And I thought, well, that's it. You know, so I didn't really ever care that the other kids weren't interested in what I was in, because as long I had a very rich fantasy life, and my parents allowed that. I had a little stage even as a kid. My parents bought me a reel-to-reel tape recorder so I could tape songs. I was the first downloader ever because I, with a reel-to-reel tape recorder, tape songs off the radio. But then, so I could sing them all and lip-sync them, basically. So I was a puppeteer as a kid. I had a job. I had a career when I was 12 years old as a puppeteer. So I always had an outlet for this that was encouraged, even though the work I was doing was probably, to this day, horrifying my parents. It was not exactly the work that they wished I was doing. But I guess they figured it was this or nothing, maybe, or prison. But they were very supportive, which was very, very, very encouraging. And I always say that. If you've got a kid that doesn't fit in, is rebelling in any way, encourage it. If your daughter comes home and she's just had her entire face tattooed, what can you do? Maybe she'll open a tattoo parlor that will do well. That's all you can do. You got to deal with what you got.
John Waters speaking with Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with John Waters. She spoke with him following an exhibition of his photographs called John Waters, Change of Life.
You also have in your show stills from your collection, publicity shots and things, shots you didn't take yourself but that you really love for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. One of them is a real cheesecake photo of Jane Mansfield. Describe the pose that she's in.
I'm trying to think. I do have a piece in the show called Jane, which is Jane Mansfield on a man's eyeglasses cracking when he looks at her, which I love that, you know. Because Divine was my Jane Mansfield. We tried to put Godzilla and Jane Mansfield together to come up with Divine. But Jane had that great scene in The Girl Can't Help It where she's walking down the street and the ice man is unloading a big block of ice and all the ice melts when he looks at her. So I love that, you know. And I've actually was with Divine before, when Divine was walking down the street and caused a car accident from people gawking and smashed right into another car. I've seen that happen.
In the catalog, you know, in the book that is a companion to your museum show, you say, you're quoted as saying, "I don't think there's anything that's trash anymore. The golden age of trash has long been over because irony ruined it." How did irony ruin trash?
Because good exploitation never was so bad it was good. It was not made for the intelligentsia. It was not made to be ironic. It was not made to be so bad it was good. I always wish my films could play at drive-ins and exploitation houses, but they never did because of irony. Those movies were made to be sexy for real or to be violent for real. They were never meant to mean something else or to be so bad they were good. So now everybody has irony. I don't think you can make, even horror films now are ironic. There is no such thing left as true sexploitation or exploitation because irony has ruined it. Everybody's in on the joke now. Everybody's hip. Everybody has irony. No one takes anything at face value anymore. I'm guilty of it. I deal in irony like a drug dealer. That's everything I do is based on irony. I'm an irony addict.
Something else that you've said that's quoted in the catalog that I want to mention, and this is in reaction to a quote from the Warhol star Bridget Berlin. She said, "How can be bad? How can you be bad in your 50s? And you said in response to that, "Taking drugs when you're young can be mind-expanding if it doesn't kill you, but if you're still doing it in mid-career, it's called addiction. Being insane when you're young is sexy. Insane at 50 is pitiful. I'm glad I got to be bad when I was young." Can you talk a little bit more about that?
The only way you can be bad later in life is to do it through your work. I mean, through your films, your artwork, your photographs. Then you can be bad. I have some bad pieces in my show. But at the same time, what I said there is true. It's only fun if you're beginning to be a big rebel. I think if you haven't learned something and refined it and kept going with it and using humor and hopefully wit with it, being shocking is easy. That's not hard. But being shocking in a way that makes you laugh and maybe makes you look at something in a different way and change how you see it is much harder. And I think that is sort of your duty if you're using humor as you continue on in your career.
Can I ask you what your impressions of aging are so far? You're, what, in your 50s now?
Yes, 57.
Yeah, so, you know, you were so long known as, like, the young subversive filmmaker, and now you've kind of come into a different identity, which is more like the mentor and the icon for a lot of independent filmmakers.
A filth elder.
Oh, couldn't have put it better myself.
I'm fine. I still feel like I'm 12 years old, basically. When I do video signings and I go to colleges a lot and speak, my average age of the kids today that come see me is like 22. That's the thing I'm the most proud of. I do have youth spies, people that tell me new groups and stuff. I think that's important. But I do keep up. I don't think my day was better. I don't think the old times were better. I think tomorrow is always going to be more interesting to me. But at the same time, I'm still doing what I've always done, but I've changed with the times. I'm certainly not going to make an underground movie when we don't have them anymore. I'm not going to make a midnight movie when we have independent films. I've tried to keep up with how the films are shown and who they appeal to. But basically, I probably am the happiest I've ever been right now in my life. I think everything is going very, very well. So it's not like I'm sitting around wanting to get a facelift. I mean, I see pictures and I think, God, I mean, everybody looks in the mirror and, you know, pulls your to see what it would look like. But it doesn't look like that. Even good facelifts of people I know, they just look like somebody else. I don't want to look like somebody else if I'm younger. I would like to. Or they look like the scary ones when you go to Los Angeles the first couple of days. I'm always like, ah, nice to meet you. Because, but they all look like that. It's cubist. They look like Picasso prints.
What about your body? Does your body still feel like a 12-year-old, or are you noticing?
Well, I was never known for being Mr. America. You know, if I could go to the gym to have the body of a junkie, I'd go. I'm probably the only gay man, you know, that's never been to the baths or the gym. I like skinny, you know. I think skinny looks good.
I was thinking of, like, aches and pains of aging and how...
Oh, I thought you were talking about body meaning, like, how it looks.
The look. Well...
Yeah. Well, let's just say I haven't been to a lot of nude beaches lately. Although, if you go to nude beaches, everyone's ugly. Have you ever been to a nude beach?
I have not.
It's the ugliest people. I'm telling you, please put your clothes on. It's never the cute ones. It's all the ugliest people that are nude. And I feel like calling the police when I go to a nude beach because no one's cute. I'm for nudity if you're cute.
Filmmaker John Waters speaking with Terry Gross. It's the final day of big, bombastic, brassy, and trashy week. We'll keep it trashy in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Next on our salute to trashiness is humorist David Rakoff, a regular contributor to public radio's This American Life, whose latest collection of comic essays is called Fraud. Not that we think Rakoff is trashy, but he seems to take delight in accepting some unusual jobs. Like posing as Sigmund Freud in the window of a department store. Or taking a day job on that much maligned form of daytime TV, the soap opera. Terry spoke with Rakoff in 2001, after the publication of Fraud.
One of your pieces in your new collection, Fraud, is about a small part you had in a daytime soap. And you say in the piece, you know that soap fans would have killed to be on the set with you, but you don't watch these programs. You had no idea who the actors were. And so, you like, being in their presence didn't mean a thing to you. Isn't it strange to be with people who you know are really famous in some circles, and you have no idea who they are?
It's very strange. And they were extremely conscious of the fact that soap opera fame is fame of a very specific sort. It's actually not unlike public radio fame. You know, it's there's a very strict subculture to these things. So these people were, to a man and woman, gorgeous New York acting folk. I mean, they were beautiful. They had attenuated limbs and perfect skin. And, you know, when we were in the rehearsal room in the morning, all their signifiers were incredibly stylish and urban. There was one woman in a pair of black cigarette pants and a black beret. I mean, she looked like Faye Dunaway and Bonnie and Clyde. And she was just fantastic looking. But there was this vague sense of apology for the fact that they seemed to understand that the nature of their fame was exurban, out there, you know, among a very specific group and, you know, multitudes, but a very specific group of daytime television watchers. And they didn't seem to comport themselves with the kind of, well, I'm just terribly famous and you should have heard who I am. You know, they immediately saw me for what I was, which is, I mean, at that point, I guess I came in as an actor in New York City. It never would have occurred to them that I would have watched the soap opera.
What was your part on the soap?
I played a modeling agent from the big city. I think I played a modeling agent from New York City, in fact, or Chicago. I think it was New York. And I was passing through the town, the fictional town that this soap opera took place in. And apparently, although I had never been on the soap opera before, I passed through that town a lot, you know, because I'm always checking out what's happening there fashion-wise. Seems to be a hotbed of fashion, apparently. And there was a fashion show, and I was at the Country Club, which is the main set, you know, the place where they all congregate to act out the little dramas. And there was a fashion show there, and I was just checking things out, and I see one of the town lovelies, you know, I can't remember her name. I think I gave her a pseudonym, obviously, in the book. I didn't want to incriminate anyone. And I see her, and I am deeply interested in her in both a professional and I thought, you know, it helped my character, a possibly sort of predatory, vulpine kind of way. And I'm insinuatingly unctuous, and I try and get her to, you know, leave this podunk two-horse town and follow me to New York City or Chicago. I can't remember. And participate in this small but terribly important fashion show that I'm organizing. And she rejects my advances, but I am, you know, slitheringly immune to, you know, the cold shoulder, and I then leave. I never appeared again, sadly.
Did you have any great lines in the part that stick out in your mind?
I'm trying to remember my lines. It was something like, I feel like I'm discovering a new talent. I mean, the way you wear a dress, your look, just things like that. Just fantastically good, slimy. Yeah, he was a slime ball. And I was wearing my own clothes, of course, because they give you $10 extra if you bring your own costume.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, so I was acting with my house keys on my person.
Huh.
Which was...
Did you look different from the rest of the cast? Because they're all these afternoon soap stars, and you're not.
I looked so very different from the rest of the cast. It was really... you know, they're gorgeous. They're not just pretty. They're heart-stoppingly beautiful people. Their faces are mathematically precise, you know, cross-culturally beautiful. And I am, in a word, not. So it, you know, I also have a certain kind of ethnic look. I have a certain careworn Jewish quality to my face. So, yeah, I did sort of stand out in that way. Happily, there were a lot of extras at this particular episode, because they were playing the other people in the audience at the fashion show. And they all tended to be senior citizens, because there's this vast network of lonely seniors in New York whose kick is to go be extras at soap operas. They all knew one another, and they had all clearly worked on all the other soaps that played in New York, that filmed in New York. So they all knew one another. And then there was me, and then there was this aesthetic super race.
You write in your piece that the typical parts you get are either Jewy McHebrew or Fudgy Packer. Would you describe...
Fudgy McPacker, yes.
Fudgy McPacker, yeah. Would you
they're
describe...
They're Scots. they're two Scottish clans. Well, the McHebrews are your prototypical Jewish clan. So that's... I'm either sent for one of two parts. I no longer really act with any frequency except for the Seder. I don't get sent on auditions. But I... Jewy McHebrew is generally a kind of a careworn... careworn twice in the same interview. I'm so sorry. But he's a kind of inquiring, furrowed-browed, bookish type who can either be the kind of guy who... And he speaks rather quickly with the kind of inquiring people of the word, people of the book. And he says things like... with dentated final consonants. So he says, Papa, I can't believe it. You sold the store? Or he plays the kind of humanist... rabbi type who says, you know, and so we eat the bitter herbs. Why? Because it is to remember the bitterness of in Egypt. You know, that's the Jewy McHebrew type, generally. Or he's a psychiatrist. They're like, huh, how do you understand that? Whereas Fudgy McPacker is, the gay character. And he can take a various variety of forms. There's, you know, supercilious Fudgy McPacker, and he's generally a hotel concierge or a makeup clerk or a waiter, and he drolls. He's more like, no, we're not carrying that this season. Next. You know, and he's just too bored, too cool for school. But there's the other Fudgy McPacker type who is gaining great currency right now culturally, and he is the lovable queen who everybody loves. He gets the best lines. He's replaced, for want of a better term, the fat girl within the dramatic pantheon. You know, Fudgy McPacker, the funny one, now gets the best lines. Like, did somebody say swim team? And, you know, that becomes his catchphrase, and they put that on T-shirts, and then he's, you know, 10 years hence, he's opening malls, and he's a bitter, bitter, bitter sociopath as a result.
A bitter McPacker.
Exactly, bitter McPacker. Fudgy McBitter. And, or the other one is he's dispensing clear-eyed, you know, romantic advice, not being privy to romance himself, because, of course, you know, he has no actual sexuality. And he says things like, can't you see he's in love with you? Just tell him. You know, and then they kiss, and then it's cut to Fudgy McPacker, and he sort of cocks his head. Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's not cut to Fudgy McPacker. It's cut to the dog. And the dog cocks his head and goes, yeah, and cue the dog, or cue Fudgy McPacker. Either way, terrific, terrific parts to get and be sent on, which is essentially why I stopped being an actor.
Well, what would you do when you were cast in a part that was obviously a stereotype? You knew the voice of the stereotype. You could do the stereotype perfectly.
And I wouldn't do it. And resultantly, I didn't get many parts. And I also, you know, wasn't... I didn't... Frequently, when I would be asked to audition for things, I would decline to even go into the audition. And, you know, if you do that enough times, then you stop being asked, which is precisely what happened for me, which was okay. I mean, it was essentially a conscious choice on my part, you know, not to do that.
So what's the problem that when casting directors see you, all they can think of is Dewey McKeebrew or Fudgy McPacker?
Essentially, yeah. Essentially, I think that it's there, and this is not to say anything against casting directors. I think there's kind of generally a kind of a risk aversion, less so on stage. You know, on stage you can be a number of things, but in television and movies, let's face it, there's an enormous amount of money riding on these things, and so a certain risk aversion is only expected. You know, I don't blame them, but there's not, as a result, a terrible abundance of imagination in terms of casting.
David Rakoff speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. His collection of essays is called Fraud. His new collection, Don't Get Too Comfortable, will be published next spring.